Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. I'm going to talk a little bit about science today. You know, it's an endlessly fascinating topic and certainly one we love to talk about on this program. And we enjoy it even more when it means getting to visit with Bassam Shakashiri. And Bassam is a professor of chemistry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, also past president of the American Chemical Society. Bassam, always great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Larry. Always a great joy for me to be with you and our listening audience.
Well, I tell you what, I want to give our audience a chance to join in today as we talk about the intersection of science and religion. We're also going to deal with the top science developments of the past 12 months. With Bassam, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Bassam, you're joining us by phone today because you're at a University of Florida event.
I'm on my way to Gainesville to visit with colleagues at the University of Florida to give some lectures and to discuss the grand challenges that face society and scientists, and to talk about ways by which we can try to address these challenges. You know, the biggest challenge that we have, the biggest challenge that we in society and as scientists have is population growth. And if you just think for a moment, Larry, in the past 4.5 days, just take a second and think what you were doing 4.5 days ago. Don't tell me what it is. Just think of, in that time period, the net increase in the world's population has been 1 million people. In 4.5 days, population growth has netted us an increase of 1 million people. On an annual basis, this is about 80 million people. So that's a daunting challenge that we must address today as we talk about science and religion. We'll talk about that. But we also have other challenges that face us. Finite resources, water, just to mention one, food is another one, clean air. A third grand challenge is malnutrition. And, of course, obesity. Obesity is part of malnutrition. These are three grand challenges that we have to deal with successfully together, working together, addressing them with respect for each other so that we can try to advance the human condition and protect our planet. The other challenges, I just list them quickly, spreading disease. We had an example of that last year with Ebola. Another one is deadly violence. Every day on the newscast, in the newspapers, everywhere you turn around, we hear about deadly violence. And of course, war is upon us in different parts of the world.
So lots there.
Of course, climate change is another daunting challenge. So these are challenges that we want to address, talk about, understand, work together to develop ways to deal with them. The solutions we're able to solve these problems if we work together on them. They're not beyond our means. What it requires is a basic understanding of what faces us, a basic understanding of how science and technology have greatly advanced the human condition, but also have created some other problems that we have to deal with, like climate change and the lack of water, potable water. And in the next 50 years, the infrastructure of big cities all over the world is threatened. You know, Larry, I'm not a gloom and doom person, but we have to be realistic in terms of what we are dealing with here. I'm very optimistic that together, working together, not only locally, but nationally, internationally, many of these issues can be successfully addressed and even solved.
Yeah. Recently, the Pope made some interesting statements. You were mentioning climate change. The Pope made some statements about climate change. And I know you're up on what he talked about.
Yeah, he He said global warming is, and I'm quoting, mostly man-made. He said, I'm also quoting him here, I don't know if human activity is the only cause, but mostly, in great part, it is man who has slapped nature in the face. This is Pope Francis speaking. He said, we have, in a sense, taken over nature. The Pope has been, for some months now, drafting an encyclical on the environment and global warming. I understand that this encyclical is scheduled to be issued sometime in June or July. So this is a fundamental change in approach, where we live in an age of enlightenment here, and religious leaders, not only Christian leaders, but also Muslim leaders, Jewish leaders, Buddhist leaders, they're all calling attention to the dire need that we have to address the environmental issues, in particular climate change. I think this is really a crucial call on the part of the Pope to bring into the discussion and bring different parts of the world to address what is a daunting global challenge to all of us.
Yeah, well, you know, religion and faith, I guess sometimes it's at odds with science and vice versa. And I'm not quite sure why it has to be that way.
It doesn't have to be that way. Some people think it's that way. I don't think it's that way. I think there's great compatibility between science and religion. Science is not the only way of knowing and understanding. But in science, the way of knowing differs from other ways because we depend in science on empirical evidence and testable, verifiable explanations. Science and religion are based on different aspects of human experience. In science, as you know, Larry, we must have explanations and they must be based on evidence drawn from examining the natural world. That's what we do. The great satisfaction we get when we examine the beautiful, complex world that we live in and understand and unravel the secrets that nature. This is what science is. And religious faith, on the other hand, does not depend on empirical evidence. It's not necessarily altered in the face of conflicting evidence. It typically involves beliefs in supernatural forces or entities. In science, we don't know how to deal with supernatural forces. We just don't deal with them. So I think any attempt to put science and religion against each other creates an unnecessary controversy that no one really needs and doesn't contribute to respecting each other, believers and non-believers. It does not contribute to understanding the nature of human interaction and the all-important respect that we have for each other and for the environment that we belong to.
Yeah. The John Templeton Society is doing some interesting work in these areas.
This foundation, the John Templeton Foundation, they're a philanthropic organization. They catalyze discoveries that relate to the kinds of questions that you just asked me about here, the purposes of life and the interactions of people with science and with religion. This is a very good foundation. It has a very good track record. It promotes encouraging civil, informed conversations among scientists, philosophers, theologians, between experts in different fields, different areas of human endeavor, and the general public. It's a very, very good foundation. It was derived from the late Sir John Templeton, who was very optimistic in his writings and in what he did about the possibility of acquiring new spiritual understanding from a commitment to rigorous scientific research and to scholarship that relates to religious beliefs and to science. I'm a fan of what the John Templeton Foundation does, and I appreciate your bringing it up.
Yeah, it's really doing some interesting work. Carl in Madison has a comment. Carl, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I just wanted to thank the doctor. First of all, I think that the crises ahead of us, you know, oftentimes young people are handed a, say, look what you're stuck with. Look at this climate change. Look at all these challenges. But I think the way that your guest is describing this, as we can do this, you know, there's a sociologist who says we are the stories we tell ourselves and others about who we are, and then our attempts to live up to those stories. And if we can just talk about who we, the things we've done, the miraculous things we've accomplished, and extend that out into a future where we can say we can get through this difficult period, and it will be this generation who can extend that gift to another generation if they can only allow themselves to see themselves as the givers of that gift, if they can find the courage, I think we can get there. So I wanted to thank the guest for his positive approach to very difficult subjects.
No, Carl, thank you so much.
I agree with what the caller said. It sometimes, you know, it sounds like it's a difficult subject, but it really isn't, even though it's been with us for a long, long time. Science and religion are the strongest forces in society, not only today, but they have been for ages. And I think bringing thoughtful people to discuss respectfully the different matters, different domains, I should say, the different domains that science and religion deal with, I think we'd find a great deal of compatibility. Now, there are people who disagree with what I just said. For example, the British scientist Richard Dawkins, who's an atheist, he, in my opinion, unfortunately, engages in disrespectful conversations and makes statements that are disrespectful of religion. And when I talk about the element of respect, Larry, I'm talking about being respectful of fellow human beings. I'm not talking about respecting and agreeing with somebody's views and opinions. Far from it. I'm talking about being respectful of each other as human beings and engaging in meaningful conversations that help not only the youth in our society, but the adults, so that we all try to get along well with each other and try to deal with these daunting global challenges that I enumerated earlier.
Talking today with Bassam Shakashiri, professor of chemistry at UW-Madison, past president of the American Chemical Society. He comes by pretty often to talk with us about science and taking a little bit of a look today at the intersection of science and religion, and also looking at some of the top science developments of the past 12 months. Lots to talk about. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, or go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and post your questions or your comments there. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, talking with UW chemistry professor Bassam Shakashiri about faith and science and a whole lot more. And again, chime in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Peter in Wauwatosa, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, I'm a former Army officer, and I'm an enlightened deist kind of agnostic person. But what shocked me, I was researching George Washington and the First Army and Napoleonic Wars and all that, and how humans first made gunpowder. One-third of gunpowder in the chemistry is potassium nitrate. And how you make gunpowder in primitive, colonial times, is you collect human urine, okay? And why, whether there's intelligent design or there's, evolutionary advantage, why does the human body naturally create one-third of gunpowder, which is potassium nitrate, either to shoot deer or to shoot Aztecs and Incas or Native Americans in New England in the Metacomet War against Boston? to blow away the enemy is quite an evolutionary advantage. And why does our human chemistry give us gunpowder if there's a intelligent design or a loving God or whatever?
Advances in science and in subsequent technologies really benefit society a great deal, but they also come with other discoveries that we have to deal with very carefully. And so inventions, once you invent something, you cannot disinvent it. So once you invent the gun, you cannot disinvent the gun, but you can decide whether you want to use the gun or not. So what happens in the course of human history is that we make these discoveries, and they are used at different times for different purposes. I'm a strong advocate of being responsible in the use of the results of the discoveries. Look, gunpowder has been around for a long, long time. The Chinese used that. Other societies also used that. So I don't think there was anything unusual or terribly peculiar to what you just shared with us, other than it's noteworthy to me that this was used to attack other people and to kill other people.
Yeah.
So I just want to be careful in stating my own position about this, and that is to be fully responsible for all the discoveries, all the inventions that human beings come up with, so that they are used for the benefit of society, for advancing the human condition, not for destructive purposes, not for attacking each other, but to try to deal with situations, difficult societal situations, social situations that require respect for the other person as a human being.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying that we should not have ourselves prepared to prevent attacks on us from other people who don't feel the same way. We should be protecting ourselves, no question about it. But to me, education is the key to combat and to successfully conquer all of these different manifestations of who we are as human beings.
Yeah, education. What is that? How people can? I'm looking for some ways that people can reconcile their faith and science. What are some ways that they can do that?
Well, I think the best way is to understand one's own faith and try to converse with others about it and about how that faith relates to society that we live in. We're in society now. The greatest advances that we have in society are the results of discoveries and developments and innovations in science and in technology. And try to reconcile those. Science and religion deal with different domains of human endeavor. The important, to me, the most important part is to be respectful. I keep saying that, Larry, respectful of the other person, not necessarily respecting their views or their beliefs, but respectful of their right as fellow human beings to have the beliefs that they have. Now, when it comes to indoctrination, and it comes to conversion and to coercion and to doing things in the name of religion, I mean, we have examples throughout history, including today, of extremism in the name of religion everywhere. That to me is the result of misunderstanding of what religion is, misunderstanding of the teachings of the great faiths that we have around the world. And it is actually not religion. It is something that's done in the name of religion, and it is done wrongly, and it is not to be allowed, not to be tolerated. That is not what I'm talking about. That's why I emphasize the element of respect and the element of trust in the conversations that we have with each other, to understand the purposes of our beliefs, to understand the meaning of our beliefs, to reconcile what we have benefited from in terms of advances in science and technology with our own beliefs. There are many scientists of all faiths, outstanding scientists. The director of the National Institutes of Health, Francis Collins, is a Christian believer. The Dalai Lama is a believer in science. Pope Francis, we mentioned him already. I have some Muslim and some Jewish friends who are very, very strong in their achievements, very recognized for their achievements in science and technology, but they're also believers. I have others who are atheists as well. So I don't see it as being a reason for discontent, as being a reason for a huge unnecessary controversy.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned where we talked about the John Templeton Foundation earlier. They are sponsoring an initiative geared toward teaching science in the Muslim world that I thought was interesting.
Yes. Among their many projects is that encouragement to support a task force that has been set up in the Muslim world that trying to improve science education at different Muslim universities. In fact, the co-chair of this task force is a colleague of ours from the American University of Sharjah. His name is Nidal Gusum. He was a guest with us about 6-7 years ago in Madison.
Mm-hmm.
He's an astronomer. He's an astrophysicist, and he and others are determined to improve the quality of science education and to advance the understanding of how science and religion work with each other. Gusum and his colleagues are all Muslim believers. They're outstanding people in terms of their commitment to the human condition, to advancing the human condition. They're concerned about deadly violence. They're concerned about war. They're concerned about climate change. They're concerned about our finite resources. The whole area of population growth and how religion relates to what we can do about population growth. All of these are being supported and being examined by this task force on science at universities in the Muslim world, and it's supported by the Templeton Foundation. I'm very, very pleased to see that happen.
Dan in Oconomowoc, we'll give you a chance to join in now. Hi, Dan. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I had a question for Basham about India taking on passive nuclear when there's no good way to get rid of the spent waste, and we just had a 30-year moratorium on our plants.
Say that again, Dan.
Dan was interested in your opinion on India going with more nuclear power when there's no safe way to get rid of the waste.
The whole energy question is a big question that we again have to deal with. I know, Larry, one of the things I really like about your program, about your show, that you have different people coming up. I think you may have some people coming up next week to talk about energy changes and so on. Energy demands in India, in China, in the U.S., everywhere are so high, and we have to find ways to mitigate our use of fossil fuels. And one of the ways is to use nuclear energy. Now, there are consequences to the use of nuclear energy. That is, they have to have waste disposal, safe waste disposal. That's a situation that's not only true in India, but elsewhere. And we just have to be careful about how much energy we use, how we use it, and we have to be thoughtful about alternative sources of energy, including nuclear energy. In Wisconsin, for example, we closed down one of the nuclear plants recently. There haven't been too many nuclear plants open in the U.S. in the past 2-3 decades. This is a great concern everywhere. Now, if Dan is talking about nuclear arms, that's also related to this, but But that requires, in my opinion, being very careful about starting power plants ostensibly for peaceful purposes, but easily converting them for making nuclear warheads. I would be very, very concerned about that.
Dan, thanks again. President Obama is in India right now, I believe, negotiating on this very topic. And I did want to mention on Wednesday, we are going to have a show on peak oil and fracking. So just something to think about. Ruth and Madison, your turn. Thank you for calling, Ruth.
Hi. Well, I just wanted to say that I'm a Christian, but I do not see creationism and, for example, the Big Bang Theory as mutually exclusive. Because, for example, if we define a day, you know, as the Bible says on the first day, you know, and mm-hmm. things like that, well, if the Earth had not yet rotated upon its axis one time, which would be the definition of a day, until the Earth actually rotates on its axis one time, we haven't had the first day yet. You know what I mean? And, or the whole period is the first day. So zillions of years can pass before the first day happens. You know, do you know what I'm saying? Or before the first day ends. And also because there's a lot of things just about the Big Bang and whatnot that we don't even know or we haven't all put together yet. For example, on a tour of Lake Mendota or something, or maybe it was over at Devil's Lake State Park, they were showing pieces of rock and saying, well, the equator used to pretty much run down the Mississippi River. You know, the Earth was rotated like 90 degrees, or however you rotate a sphere, 90 degrees. And that the north and south axis was really the where the rotation occurred. So then again, it leads me to, well, is it a day defined as the day the Earth rotated on this axis, you know, or what? And so, you know, we don't even know, for example, if gravity was less at the time that the dinosaurs were here. Maybe we didn't have the mass on the planet. Maybe a giant asteroid of ice crashed into what's now the Yucatan Peninsula and melted there, you know, but the impact of it put the Earth on a different rotation, and then the ice all melted and we got more water and all kinds of stuff changed. We don't know any of this.
Bassam, I want to give Bassam a chance to comment. Hi, Bassam, you want to comment?
Yeah, yes, Ruth, thank you for your comments. I just want to say again that, you know, science and religion are based on different aspects of human experience. And what you talked about, the age of the planet, the age of the universe, and so on, and this is all in the realm of science. That's not at odds with religion. The interpretation, the literal interpretation of what the Bible says, for example, is not something we should actually be doing, because the Bible is not a science book. The Bible is a great source of spirituality. It's a great source of ways by which we as human beings interact with each other, but it's not a science book. So we have to, through science education, we have to learn about the differences between what is in the science domain and what is in the religious belief domain. And as I said before, in science, explanations must be based on evidence. And this evidence is drawn from experimentation, from examining the natural world.
And Ruth, I thank you so much for calling. I appreciate it. I want to give Dan in La Crosse a chance to join in. He's been waiting a long time. Dan, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry and Sam. I've personally observed two situations where young men fathered multiple kids, seven kids or more. Then the Christian gospel came into their lives, and they took on a proper sense of self-worth, responsibility, accountability, And you talked about population growth. Dr. Luis Palau told about a valley in Brazil that was full of poverty, drug abuse. The Christian gospel came there, and the people got a different sense of who they were and to whom they were accountable, and it transformed their lives. And they stopped having children that they couldn't take care of. Their income went up. Their health went up. So I think religion, proper religion, can bring self-esteem and change from the inside out.
And dignity. Okay, very good. Thank you so much for calling, Dan. But Sam, what do you think?
Yes, Dan. Once again, a lot of human behavior is dependent on what we learn and what we do with what we learn. That's why I'm a strongest advocate you can ever meet for improving education. And trying to put everything that we deal with as human beings in the proper perspective. So the issue of population growth and the influence of religion on population growth and the political action that happens not only in this country but around the world that relates to population growth is of great importance for all of us to deal with respectfully. Whether it's birth control, or eradication of disease, or poverty, you mentioned that. All of these are very, very important parts of what we have to learn about and decide for ourselves what pathways we want to try to pursue. It's not just an individual decision. It's a collective decision. Because for us collectively, what's at stake is the future of the planet. What's at stake is the future of society, locally, nationally, and internationally. It's the quality of life that is really at stake here. And so religious teachings should be respected. Scientific evidence should be looked at very carefully. And then conclusions for behavior, for action, is one of the best ways to pursue a good, fulfilling, rewarding life. That's what I believe in. A long time ago, when I was a youngster in my native Lebanon, I taught Sunday school, and I think religion has a place in society, has a very crucial, important place in society. But I think enlightenment is what we have to benefit from. That, Larry, that's what the Wisconsin idea is all about, is to share the results of advances in knowledge with everyone in Wisconsin. That's what education is all about. That's what the universities and colleges and schools are all about. So as they then affect our behavior as responsible inhabitants of the planet.
And Dan, I want to thank you again for calling. I appreciate it very much. I want to give Gary and Merrill and then Michael and Bayfield a chance. Gary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, good morning. I grew up on a dairy farm, and we had so many acres of land that could produce so much food. So we had to limit the amount of animals on the farm. And I can't see why that idea doesn't work with human population. I don't think it's that we don't have enough food and water, housing and everything. It's just there's too many people, and I think there was more talked about in the 70s than there is now, and we had half as many people in the world as we do now.
Hmm. Well, population growth, as I said earlier, is the biggest challenge that we have, and the other grand challenges, we can do something about them if we are successful in dealing with population growth. It's just 1 million people net increase in 4.5 days is not something that's going to lead to a sustainable society. It's not going to lead to a sustainable planet that we live on. We just don't have enough resources in food and in water. They're over around the globe right now as we speak. There are over 1.3 billion people who cannot have a drink of potable water. This is just, you know, this is the 21st century. So there are distribution problems that relate to the finite resources, but they're finite. They're not inexhaustible, and that's why we've got to be careful about the rate at which population is growing around the globe. And it's growing much faster in impoverished parts of the world, and that's going to lead to more malnutrition. It's going to lead to more spreading of disease. It's going to lead to more deadly violence. It's going to lead to war. It's going to affect the climate change. So that's why focusing primarily, but not only, on population growth is very, very important for us to do.
Michael, a quick question.
Yes, I'd like to shift the conversation a bit. I'd like Bashira to give us some teasers about the technological breakthroughs that are happening right now and in the near future.
Oh, we've got about a minute to do that, Bassam.
Technological breakthroughs. Well, great discoveries in the nanosciences are being made. They're going to transform society. The electronic revolution is upon us. What we do with it, how we handle it, how we benefit from it, how we prevent it from causing more anxiety, more stress in society is important. The electronic revolution is going, in my opinion, going to be more profound than the industrial revolution. We all now benefit from the great advances from the industrial revolution, but the electronic revolution is really something that is going to be very transformative. Advances in pharmaceuticals, in the medical sciences, advances in communication, all of those are going to be with us. But what we do as human beings, what we do as educated human beings, is going to make the hugest difference. It's going to be a fundamental difference in how we sustain ourselves on this planet.
Bassam, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. And good luck on your trip to Florida.
Thank you so much, Larry. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Bassam Shakashiri, a professor of chemistry at the UW-Madison. He always gives us a lot to think about, doesn't he? It's always such a great conversation with him. Coming up next, we're going to stay in the world of science when we talk with our weather guys. They're going to talk about what it means that 2014 was the hottest year on record and whether we are below average in snowfalls this year. Feels like it to me. What about you? I hope, stay with us here. We'll be back with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, in just a minute.